You don't have to ride Jim Crow. No, you don't.
Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Most Americans know something about the Freedom Rides, the activists of all colors who boarded buses heading south to challenge segregation in 1961. But years earlier, there was another Freedom Ride in 1947, and tomorrow is the 75th anniversary of its beginning. We commemorated it last year with a special edition of Simply Superior, which last week was named Best Documentary in the National Association of Black Journalists Salute to Excellence Awards. With that, we bring you this rebroadcast and a little bit of the backstory. In the 1990s, I had the great fortune of meeting the surviving members of that ride, and even more so, of bringing them together on a bus for a reunion reliving their trip. It was filmed for a National Public Television documentary, and now it's been adapted for radio. Here is You Don't Have to Ride Jim Crow. White, black, two societies, separate and unequal. For years, that reality ruled America, enforced by law and the lynch mob. While many detested the system, most lived with it until the day a nation's conscience could be swayed.
200,000 people converge on the nation's capital to rally for civil rights. There's a great swell of cheers to welcome Martin Luther King to the speaker's podium.
Yet years before America's most famous protest, when Martin Luther King was still a teenager, the country paid little mind when a tiny group fought one small battle for civil rights. This is their story.
You don't have to ride Jim Crow. No, you don't have to ride Jim Crow. On June the 3rd, the High Court said, when you ride in the state, Jim Crow is dead. You don't have to ride Jim Crow.
They may have looked like tourists on a sightseeing trip.
Durham, North Carolina, huh?
Yeah.
But the seven grandfathers and great-grandfathers gathering in Washington, D.C. for a trip south in the early 1990s were tracing history that they themselves had made nearly half a century before.
We were, some of us black, some of us white. And we were riding together at a time when it was illegal to do it, they thought.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Yeah.
The travelers were inspired by Irene Morgan. 11 years before Rosa Parks, Morgan refused to give up her seat in the back of an interstate bus in Virginia.
I cannot see how anyone would not have done the same thing.
Yet Morgan's defiance was the exception, not the rule, and the policy of racial segregation was well entrenched. More than just an inconvenience of blacks riding in the back of the bus or in separate train cars, segregation was a humiliation, frequently enforced by violence. It was also called Jim Crow, a phrase dating back to blackface minstrel shows of the early 1800s.
I've been traveling from toe to toe. Everywhere I have been, I find some old Jim Crow.
Wally and Juanita Nelson were African-American equal rights activists in the 1940s.
Everything was segregated. Everywhere you went, colored, white, transportation, bus station, train station. Well, we didn't go in an airplane or anything, but they would have been too if they had them at that time. So everything was marked.
The Supreme Court legitimized segregation in 1896 in its ruling in Plessy versus Ferguson, which established a practice of separate but equal. In reality, it meant always separate and always unequal.
The Jim Crow car on a train, for example, would always be old equipment.
Historian Catherine Barnes is the author of Journey from Jim Crow.
It would usually be dirty. It would be without the conveniences that you'd find in the white cars, whether it be, you know, upholstered seating or air conditioning or a water cooler or no toilet. And you'd sit there and you could see right in the next car that whites were getting infinitely better facilities than you were, and it was very maddening.
In the 1940s, Nathan Wright was a young black minister in Cincinnati, a border city between North and South.
Normal black people would say, for you to bother instead of it just going ahead and accepting things as they are, you can't change them, and there's no point in risking.
Yet there were some who did. On July 16, 1944, 27-year-old Irene Morgan was ending a visit to her family in Gloucester, Virginia, where she was recovering from a miscarriage. She boarded a bus headed for her home in Baltimore, Maryland, and joined other African-American riders in the back. 15 miles into her journey, the driver accosted her.
So my passengers got on, and the bus driver told me that I would have to move. There were no seats at all there, and I refused to move. And that's when he got off the bus, got the sheriff, and the sheriff came in and said, "I'm going to arrest you." And I said, "That's perfectly all right." Then he asked the girl in the seat next to me to move. The girl had her baby in her arms, about 5 or 6 months old, and she was going to Ardmore, Pennsylvania. And she started to get up to move. And I snatched her back because I'm wondering, where are you going? I said, "Where are you going with that baby in your arms, you know?" And then he handed me this piece of paper, supposed to be a warrant. So I just took it and tore it up and just threw it out of the window. So then when he put his hands on me, you know, to arrest me, well, I was furious with him at the time, and that's when I kicked him. I started to bite him, but he looked dirty, so I couldn't bite him. But anyway, he was bowed over. He was really in pain. So he couldn't do anything. So he got off the bus. He was turning all colors. He got off the bus. So then his deputy sheriff came.
Morgan's arrest caught the attention of a team of NAACP lawyers: Leon Ransom, Spotswood Robinson, William Henry Hastie, and Thurgood Marshall. They took her case all the way to the Supreme Court, but argued it not on humanitarian grounds, but solely that segregation violated the Interstate Commerce Clause. Historian Catherine Barnes explains the logic.
They hearken back to the decision from the Reconstruction period, Hall versus DeQueer, which had said a state civil rights law was a burden on commerce, and they argued that a state segregation law was equally a burden on commerce, if not more so, that there could be constant changing of seats as you moved from a segregated to a non-segregated state. Even within the South, there were differences in the segregation laws from one state to the next, and it could create a burden on commerce.
The American Brotherhood campaign is supported by members of the United States Supreme Court.
By 1946, the Supreme Court was far more liberal than it had been 50 years earlier when it established the doctrine of separate but equal in Plessy versus Ferguson.
Chief Justice Harlan Stone also speaks strongly in a plea for tolerance.
Freedom of the mind and the spirit has its practical aspects in everyday life.
On June 3, 1946, the court handed down its ruling in the Morgan case, agreeing with the NAACP lawyers. Again, based solely on the Commerce Clause, it ruled that segregation in interstate travel was unconstitutional. At first, African-American travelers thought that Jim Crow had been shot dead.
In the black community, there was a lot of jubilation about the decision. It was the first time the Supreme Court had ever overturned a Jim Crow law involving transportation.
Thurgood Marshall called the decision a decisive blow toward the evils of segregation. Some carriers even began removing white and colored signs, but the southern states had other intentions.
I have accepted my election, have taken my oath of office, and am now at my desk attending to the duties of my office.
In Georgia, Governor Talmadge suggested that within 50 feet of his state's border, black riders would have to get off interstate buses, then buy in-state Georgia tickets, and ride Jim Crow. Alabama Governor Chauncey Sparks called the ruling fertilizer for the Ku Klux Klan. Whether because of these threats or years of Jim Crow conditioning, most black riders were still too afraid to sit up front on interstate buses, and segregation persisted in all forms of transportation. Like Irene Morgan, not everyone accepted the status quo. George Hauser was among white and black staff members of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, a pacifist group based in New York that had turned its attention to race relations during World War II.
You might say it was natural for us to think of ways in which we could try to implement that decision by traveling through the southern states where the Jim Crow laws were in force, refusing to ride Jim Crow. There had been so many cases during the war years where you had black soldiers being discriminated against and sometimes treated violently and assaulted because they weren't riding Jim Crow.
In February 1946, a returning black GI named Isaac Woodard was told he was taking too long at a South Carolina rest stop. He was beaten and his eyes gouged out. Ironically, it was the pacifists who championed the rights of the black GIs. Along with George Hauser, they included James Farmer and Bayard Rustin.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
Bayard Rustin was born to an unwed mother and raised by his grandparents in a family of black Quakers in Westchester, Pennsylvania. He experimented with a variety of political beliefs and even tried his hand at a singing career. Born in Ohio, George Hauser spent the early years of his life in the Philippines with his family of white American missionaries. As a teenager, he joined an activist group of Methodist youth, among whom he found progressive views on race relations. Also in the Methodist youth group, and the son of a black college president, was James Farmer. In 1942, the three new hires of the Pacifist Fellowship were eager to work on race relations. That spring in Chicago, Farmer and Hauser co-founded CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. They literally invented the sit-in as a desegregation tactic at a Chicago coffee shop. The group conceived of a bus trip from Washington, D.C. to New Orleans, in which white and black riders would purposely defy Jim Crow seating laws. A name was coined for the trip, the Journey of Reconciliation. The ride was co-sponsored by CORE and the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Yet associates in the South warned the group that they would be foolhardy to attempt a ride in the Deep South, and the trip was rerouted for the Upper South only. There were also warnings about women and men participating together. George Hauser recalls.
We discussed the question of whether women should be part of the testing group because there were a good many women who were active in CORE and on our national committee who wanted to go.
Juanita Nelson was one of those activists.
I knew what was going on because I was active in CORE at the time. As a matter of fact, I was very upset because I thought it should have been an integrated journey. You know, I mean, by that, that women should be...
Husband Wally Nelson shared her point of view.
I was one of the people who says that this is... you got to have women on this. And we had people arguing that, well, you know, if you have women on it and have white women and black men... I said, well, this is the way what we believe, and this is what we ought to do.
George Hauser.
This would raise the hackles even more than just disobeying the Jim Crow traditions in the South, because you bring in another element, and that is the relation of the sexes to one another.
And it was determined finally that it would be too dangerous. I didn't agree with that. Just remember being hopping mad because I couldn't go on the original journey.
That was the idea. And I think it was thrown out for to try to appease people like me, that the women would have theirs or something.
We were a little vague on that. All we did was to say, for the moment, this will be an all-male body.
Late in 1946, George Hauser and Bayard Rustin set off on a research trip to line up support and speaking engagements. As a white and black pair, the two did not sit together.
Bayard and I decided that our task on this trip was not to get arrested. And therefore, we agreed where we were going to meet and when we were going to meet. and we both got there. And I don't remember, I don't think we ever rode on the same bus together, he riding Jim Crow and me in front. That was too much.
Seating arrangements on the buses were well thought out. Instead of traveling as one large, obvious group of blacks in front, whites in back, they broke up into smaller teams. Two riders, one black and one white, would sit side by side, directly behind the driver. A similar pair would sit in the Jim Crow section. One or two others would ride incognito and ready to sway public opinion. They also carried the bail money. 16 riders were recruited, 8 black and 8 white. The trip demanded a special breed of activists. Nathan Wright of Cincinnati was one.
Our family was run out of the state of Louisiana. My father thrown into a swamp for dead, and he had to be spirited out of the city immediately. When the opportunity came, I was ready for it. And I had a wife and 2 sons, and knew that if I took part, there was a possibility that I may not return, but I was willing to risk that.
Most, but not all, were pacifists, some so strong in their convictions that they chose prison terms rather than the alternative service offered to them as conscientious objectors during the war. All were committed to respond nonviolently to whatever might happen.
And the sun shines bright in St. Petersburg for 6,000 youngsters who, led by old Pete Rabbit himself, take off on an Easter egg hunt.
On Easter 1947, America cared little that its racial norms were about to be challenged. And if there was a racial story to notice, it was playing in a different arena.
Hit the street, Jackie Robinson, hit that ball.
On April 9th, the day before Jackie Robinson's debut in the major leagues, the group set off from Washington, D.C. Unbeknownst to them, an incident just days before underscored the dangers of their journey. A black rail passenger named Fletcher Melvin fell asleep on a train going south from Washington, D.C. He woke up in North Carolina, where he was shot and killed by a conductor for refusing to ride Jim Crow. On April 9, 1947, 9 of the group purchased Greyhound and Trailways bus tickets and boarded for Richmond, Virginia. Retracing the route on the reunion trip, the travelers make a side visit to an old friend.
Nathan Wright.
Hello, Nathan Wright. How are you?
The leader of the more famous Freedom Ride of 1961, Jim Farmer was invited on the original journey, but could not make the trip.
This is Conrad.
Conrad Lynn, how are you?
Jim, Ernest Bromley.
Ernest Bromley. I can't see you at all now. I'm totally blind.
Oh, I can't see
but,
you.
But I remember you as being very tall and thin.
I'm almost up to you.
I'm 6'1".
Yeah, I'm not quite.
Are you thin?
I'm very thin.
Yes, right.
And you are about the size you used to be, almost.
All right, a little bit fatter.
On the first leg of their journey, decades before, the riders arrived in a segregated Richmond without incident. One group traveling on Trailways, the other on Greyhound. Both teams also noticed other African-American riders crossing the color line. But the next day, 25 miles further south in Petersburg, Virginia, one man told a group, "A Negro might get away with riding up front here, but some bus drivers are crazy. And the farther south you go, the crazier they get."
We were not obviously traveling as a group.
George Hauser.
It was only when an incident took place that it became obvious that there was a group involved.
On the morning of April 11th, Conrad Lynn took a second row seat on the Trailways bus.
And they arrested me and took me off the bus and then took me to jail.
Here we were in the bus depot for probably a couple of hours. I was in the back. No attention was paid to me in that case by the police until I went up and protested the fact that Conrad was being arrested. Why wasn't I being arrested too?
meantime, there were all of us sitting on the bus.
Wally Nelson.
The people in the back, which were all black, became more frightened. The longer we were there, the more frightened they became. I was sitting in the Jim Crow, and they were saying, "He knows better than that. He should be coming back here. He knows where we're supposed to ride." And I finally said casually, "Well, if we had any guts, we'd be up there too." And no one said anything after that.
The bus driver was my best witness. They asked him, because they have to find something wrong with me. I'm just putting in the seat, you know. And they said, "Well, was he violent? No. Did he answer you back? No, he didn't. Well, how did he act? He acted like a gentleman." I didn't have to put any evidence in. The case was over.
With that first arrest, the riders learned some valuable lessons. Comporting themselves like gentlemen and using some riders to sway public opinion seemed to be paying off. But as they head further south, will it last? We'll find out as this special presentation of You Don't Have to Ride Jim Crow continues. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We resume with our special presentation of the documentary, You Don't Have to Ride Jim Crow. Crossing into North Carolina, Joe Feldman recalls his apprehension as the bus enters his home state.
I remember as we were riding to Durham, I had rested to see my reflection in the driver's rearview mirror, and he remarked that my face was very red.
This is North Carolina, the old North State, yours and ours. Its home folk bid you welcome.
George Hauser reads from the log he kept of the original journey. He refers to Bayard Rustin and Andy Johnson, both African-American and riding up front, and their white colleague, Jim Peck.
The bus from Raleigh made a stop in Durham on the way through, and as our bus came in, we saw Johnson and Rustin being taken away by the police. Johnson and Rustin were in the second seat from the front on a Trailways bus. The driver asked them to move to the rear as soon as he saw them. Peck, who was seated in about the middle of the bus, got up after the arrest, saying to the police, "If you arrest them, you'll have to arrest me too, for I'm going to sit in the rear." So he was arrested.
Watch a step there. All out for Durham, North Carolina.
The University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill is the oldest state-supported university in the nation.
In the liberal university town of Chapel Hill, the group looked forward to a respite. Wally Nelson recalls a particularly fond memory.
We had this party that was student-attended, and it was a very fun party. And since I liked to dance, I had a lot of fun.
Wally remembers all about those party thing.
Yeah, George wasn't a party person.
I was too serious.
he was on his way to heaven, and he couldn't take time to have fun.
This is Chapel Hill, the bus station. Where's the police station?
This is not the site.
This is a different place.
Yeah, right.
Familiar landmarks have changed in 47 years.
What street are we coming to?
Chapel Hill bus station.
What, right here?
That's it?
I believe
the
it was.
Station?
Yeah.
You betcha. Where's the bus station?
Uh-huh. It's been torn down.
Well, this is the place. It's not the bus station as of today.
No.
But this is where it was.
The spot.
47 years ago. This building was not here. This whole area, including this parking lot, was the bus depot. Taxi cab drivers were lined up along here and probably some across the way.
After a restful night, the group set out to leave Chapel Hill on April 13th. A black and white pair, Andy Johnson and Joe Feldman, sat three seats behind the driver. Feldman tells what happened next.
The bus driver got off the bus, went to the police station,
which
or
was right across the way here.
Well, I'm not sure where it was.
It actually was right there. That was the building.
Well, he did have far to go.
Yeah.
And he complained to the police that a white man and a black man were sitting together on his bus.
Johnson and Felmet explained that they were friends traveling together. Even though Felmet was white and sitting up front, both were arrested. The bus was delayed nearly 2 hours.
At this point, Egal Rudenko and Bayard Rustin felt that the reaction among the passengers was so positive, because people protested against the arrest, that they decided to move up from the back to the front.
Jim Peck, who was the writer traveling incognito, attempted to call the Reverend Charles Jones, with whom the group had stayed the night before.
I remember the cabin parking over there. Some parked over there coming this way.
Yes.
And maybe some across the street, because there were quite a number of them.
While Jim was out making the phone call, the cab drivers attacked him, and he was struck.
Hilton Seals, the Reverend Jones' assistant, happened to be passing by.
When they were sort of being assaulted and insulted and everything else.
Charles Jones' wife, Dorcas Jones, also recalls the frantic events.
Charles's assistant at the church went by there and saw what was happening and called Charles.
I called Preacher Jones from down at the phone at the police station.
At the meantime, the cab drivers were organizing, and Charlie Jones came down in his car.
He went down and got the men, put them in the car, and brought them home. And the cab driver started after him, and he took a shortcut and got there before they did.
And I remember steaming up this street and then turning to the right and going up to Charlie's home and dashing across his lawn while the cab drivers were chasing us. And they got to his house, and then they came with rocks in their hands.
They threatened and had sticks and whatnot out front, but they stopped short of coming.
One of the cabs drove right up on the lawn, and I thought for a moment that the car was going to crash right through the door.
The sanctuary of the Jones home was short-lived. As daylight faded, the cab drivers were still threatening.
A phone call came very shortly after that to Charlie Jones saying, get the out of town or we're going to burn your house down. We then had to have a very quick decision about what were we going to do.
These riders had to go on to Greensboro, and they were afraid to go out. So we had to call the police, and it was a rather slow process according to my timing. And finally, a policeman came, and Charles took them to the county line with the help of the police.
The Joneses' daughter, Betty, remembered the incident as a child.
I was 12, 1947. I guess I kind of found it exciting. I didn't know enough, I guess, to be fearful until we had to leave the house.
Charles Jones evacuated his family from their home for 2 weeks.
I remember driving to Greensboro, and I remember Mother kept turning around and looking out the back window. And I could tell that she was very upset and very worried because they had said they would harm us.
You are Charles' daughter, Betty.
I see.
Yes, I was 12 at that time.
Oh, boy. Isn't that something?
I remember you as taller, but of course I was shorter.
The students rose up in our defense, and they came and stayed at my place. And while since Charlie and Preacher Jones and Dorcas weren't home, they stayed at the manse. There was one morning that a guy came by, and the students went running out to grab him and to beat him up.
And said, what do you think you're doing? And this little boy said, I'm just delivering the paper, mister.
Hilton, I'm Joe Feldman. I'm a member of the reunion event here. And we know that in Chapel Hill, when we were threatened by the cab drivers, that you called Charlie Jones and helped us out. So I'd like to crown you with this.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you, Hilton.
Thank you.
It was a long ride across North Carolina from Greensboro to Asheville. We went through this rural area and through these small towns and villages. There were no more seats, and here you had Wally sitting up in front. And somebody would go up to the bus driver, and he said, "I can't do anything about it. Blame those bastards up in Washington."
Great city of the mountain country, Asheville is the heart of the land of the sky.
9 days into the journey, the group prepared to leave Asheville for Knoxville, Tennessee. Dennis Banks and Jim Peck, a black and white pair riding up front, were arrested. Attorney Curtis Todd traveled all night from Winston-Salem to represent them.
Banks and Peck were arrested, and the next day, or I think it must have been the next day, there was a hearing in the police court. With Judge Cathy, a blind judge, police court judge. After presenting the Supreme Court decision about the interstate bus trial, he indicated that he would dismiss it.
During the second week of the journey, the riders divided up to cover more territory, traveling in twos and threes. On April 17th, with Homer Jack sitting in the rear, Nathan Wright took a front seat on a late-night bus from Knoxville to Nashville.
When we got on, it was quickly realized that there was trouble in the making. My presence being one half of the trouble and Homer Jack's presence being the other half. They openly discussed some massive action, really mob action, against me. We came to an area where there was just pitch black. No lights burning anywhere. You couldn't tell whether there were houses around or what. The bus stopped. The driver opened the door, looked at his watch, waited there for a moment, then got out and looked around, and then talked with one or two people who were on the bus, and they said, "Shall we wait here, or have they gathered somewhere else?" I could hear all this, and it was done in a calculated way for me to hear. They were all lynching parties that were threatened. It was a frightening, harrowing experience for me to sit there and not have the slightest idea when my executioners would arrive and when my execution would occur. This kind of thing happened with variations at about five or six places along the road.
Meanwhile, back in Asheville, some of the group found a true respite in nearby Black Mountain College, one of the very few interracial gathering places in the South at the time.
It was like an oasis, and people were associating as if color didn't matter a damn.
And it didn't.
It didn't matter a damn. So it was so wonderful to get into this whole scene. It was just terrific.
That's right.
Yeah.
And in this beautiful setting.
Yeah.
By the 10th day, the group started riding trains as well as buses, and on April 23rd, they concluded their trip. In all, there were 26 tests of the seating laws, 12 riders were arrested, and there was only one incident of violence. Through the black press, they vigorously publicized their success. Hauser and Rustin were so jubilant, they even wrote a song about it, and Rustin recorded it.
You don't have to ride Jim Crow.
The Asheville case and others were thrown out, but the Chapel Hill conviction stood. The group looked to the national NAACP to make good on a loose promise to handle their appeals.
Go quiet like if you face arrest, NAACP will make a test. You don't have to ride Jim Crow.
But the NAACP did not take the case, and somehow the bus tickets needed for evidence were lost.
We had given the stubs of tickets to the NAACP. I don't think they wanted to take the case on up, and they said that they had lost the stubs.
Historian Catherine Barnes.
There was nothing in the records of the national organizations, either of CORE or of the NAACP, that would suggest that anything was deliberately done to sabotage their cases. Now, that doesn't mean there wasn't some conflict between the organizations or a certain amount of rivalry.
We had good relations with the NAACP leadership, and we talked with them about it. They were a little skeptical about it. Thurgood Marshall was not happy about it.
Many people in the NAACP and in the black community generally were very wary of getting too involved with an organization promoting nonviolent direct action.
They also indicated maybe they'd get a better case. I don't know. The fact is that our cases did not go on up to the courts.
They were extremely careful about what cases they took up on appeal. It's very easy with hindsight to look back now and see what seems like a very steady progression in the Supreme Court cases leading up to Brown versus the Board of Education, where they hold segregation unconstitutional. And it looks now, from our perspective, almost inevitable. But in fact, it wasn't inevitable.
With no further appeals, the Chapel Hill conviction stood. Rustin, Rudenko, Johnson, and Felmet were sentenced to 30 days on a chain gang. So incensed was the judge about Felmet's participation as a white man in a Jim Crow case that he attempted to sentence him to 6 months.
Our lawyer made the valid point that he couldn't do that because the maximum sentence was 30 days.
Johnson paid a fine, but the other three surrendered to authorities. Rustin's account of his time on a chain gang was published in the New York Post. It did spark some reform in North Carolina prisons, but the group's hope for igniting a mass movement against racial injustice was lost for the moment. Yet, only for the moment, Nathan Wright.
It was under the leadership of CORE during the time when I served as the New England Field Representative that Martin Luther King Jr. first came into contact with the idea and the practice of nonviolent direct action as applied to race relations.
The journey would inspire other actions, including that of one African-American traveler who just months after the journey successfully sued Greyhound for violating his rights as an interstate passenger. And the journey participants themselves would go on to make significant contributions. George Hauser co-founded the American Committee on Africa, spending 30 years on the continent assisting black liberation movements. Nathan Wright went on to chair the Black Power Conference in Newark, New Jersey in 1967, all the while remaining a pacifist. Wally and Juanita Nelson lived out much of their days off the grid in western Massachusetts, becoming folk heroes as living examples of coexisting with nature.
Well, this is the famous old outhouse.
And the two-seater. Some of our baskets. It has served us well, I'd say.
Byard Rustin took what he learned from the journey to directly advise Martin Luther King during the Montgomery bus boycott. He went on to orchestrate the 1963 March on Washington, then the largest peaceful gathering in the nation's history. And Jim Peck, who was attacked in Chapel Hill, again put his life on the line as the only person to participate in both the journey and the more famous 1961 Freedom Ride. This time, it did go to the Deep South, where Peck was severely beaten in Birmingham, Alabama. The attack on them outraged the world. The journey activists put it in context.
Certainly the Freedom Ride of 1961 was built upon what we had done in 1947, and I think they learned something from it.
I have been on a panel, for instance, talking about the civil rights movement, and everybody thinks about the 1960s, so I talk about the 1940s, and people are quite astonished. You know, that, oh, yeah, something, there were people breathing back in the 40s, you know.
These types of things were being done, and even before 1947, they were being done. And that why 1960 was such a big picture is because everything built up to 1960 to make it what it was. Just then, 1960, and here we take off. We had a strong foundation.
It is a tremendously significant story, and so much that has been written since could never have come out the way that it has done. If it were not for the foundation that was laid by the Journey of Reconciliation.
In many respects, the Journey of Reconciliation was an action ahead of its time. It did not directly implement the Morgan decision. It did not immediately desegregate interstate transit. But the Journey and its participants did lay the groundwork for actions taken in later cases by thousands to end legalized segregation in America. You Don't Have to Ride Jim Crow was produced by me, Robin Washington, originally presented by New Hampshire Public Television, and this presentation by Wisconsin Public Radio. For a complete list of personnel, as well as educational materials and research on the Journey and its participants, go to robinwashington.com/Jim Crow. Once again, robinwashington.com/Jim Crow. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. The television version of You Don't Have to Ride Jim Crow premiered nationwide on PBS stations in 1995, and it's aired many times in the years since then. It's also had dozens, if not hundreds, of screenings at colleges, houses of worship, and movie theaters across the country. When I produced it, I had no idea it would take on a life of its own, and pretty much consume my life as well, though certainly for the better. Since then, about 1 million people have seen it, but I still meet people who've never heard of any of it. So how do you reach them? Well, one thing we're good at in America is entertainment, and several years ago, the idea occurred to me to try a musical route. Lyrics for the documentary score, composed by jazz pianist Anthony Wanzi, almost wrote themselves, and with the help of Twin Ports performers Ryan Frain, Gabe Mayfield, and Dante Perto, we brought a bit of it to a small stage, courtesy of the Duluth Playhouse. I recently came across a cassette tape of that performance. I told you it was a while ago, and you'll excuse the scratchy quality, which we're happy to share with you now. Yes, the rest of the musical still needs to be completed, and Gabe Mayfield is forever on me to do so. But for now, here's a start. Here are 3 songs from You Don't Have to Ride Jim Crow, the musical.
Chapel Hill is waiting, we got people to meet. Black and white is Jim Crow is dead. You don't have to ride Jim Crow.
And when you get on the bus, and when you get on the bus, get on the bus, sit any place, cause Irene Morgan won her case. You don't have to ride Jim Crow.
Oh, you don't have to ride Jim Crow. No, you don't have to ride Jim Crow. Oh, June the 3rd, the High Court said, when you ride in a state, Jim Crow is dead. You don't have to ride Jim Crow.
Now you can sit anywhere. Now you can sit anywhere. Sit anywhere, don't raise no fuss. Keep cool, my brother, your cause is just. You don't have to ride Jim Crow.
Oh, you don't have to ride Jim Crow. No, you don't have to ride Jim Crow. Oh, June the 3rd, the High Court said, when you ride in a state, Jim Crow is dead. You don't have to ride Jim Crow.
And if the driver man says move, and if the driver man says move, if the driver says move, speak up polite, but sit there tight, you're in the right. You don't have to ride Jim Crow. And someday we'll all be free, yes. Someday we'll all be free when united actions turn the tide and black and white sit side by side. Oh, someday we'll all be free.
To the judgment day, oh,
that was Ryan Frayne on piano with Gabe Mayfield and Dante Pertle performing three songs from the soon-to-be, we hope, musical version of You Don't Have to Ride Jim Crow. If you're interested in the progress of the rest of the show, please drop me a line at robin.washington@wpr.org. And that's it for this special edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.